is announced ready. I'll introduce the panel quickly. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Dana Womack. And I'm Elizabeth Kerr. Unless there is any reason not to, I'll ask the clerk to call the first case.
The court will now call the State of Texas versus Jose Manuel Gonzalez. May it please the court, Ms. Donna Kraftchick will argue for the state. Mr. Jason Smith will argue for the appellate.
May it please the court, Donna Kraftchick on behalf of the State of Texas would show the court that there are multiple grounds for reversing the default judgment. The most straightforward basis is the lack of jurisdiction over Mr. Gonzalez's claims, and those claims would be the takings claim, the declaratory judgment claim, and the other theories of constitutional violations. Even if the court did find jurisdiction over those claims, there's also problems with the evidence. The default judgment and award of attorney's fees was an abuse of discretion given the insufficient, factually and legally, the insufficient evidence to support either of those the award or the default judgment. And finally, the state would show that the trial court lacked jurisdiction over the state of Texas with respect to these civil claims. The state was never served with process. No citation was served on the state to provide notice of these claims filed against it, and there was never any notice of the trial setting served on the state of Texas.
The trial. So do you find any significance in the fact that the Tarrant County Criminal DA filed a general denial in response to Mr. Gonzalez's initial counterclaim?
Not having been participating in that proceeding, it's not clear why the Tarrant County DA filed an answer of any sort. I suppose it was just to try to help the court understand, because they did file the special plea and the motion is dismissed, to explain the lack of jurisdiction over the state and the defect that there was no service. They presented, They presented information that the Secretary of State needed to be served so the state could come in on civil claims. So I would point out that there's the difference between the criminal claims that were prosecuted in the name of the state and the civil claims that were brought, and this attorney general would typically be assigned those claims to represent the state.
But does it matter why they filed an appearance? I mean, if they answer the case with a general denial, isn't that a general appearance?
Well, they were not authorized to represent the state in that matter.
Well, the state has never asserted anywhere in the trial court that the district attorney's office was not authorized to represent it, did it?
Well, the state never had an opportunity. We presented a motion for a new trial, and the county court at law, just said, I think the state was here, that's the end of it.
Well, but the proceeding in the justice court was filed by the DA's office in the name of the state of Texas as its client, correct?
Yes, for the criminal charges.
And then when the case was appealed to the county court, the counterclaim was made and an appearance was made by the DA's office on behalf of the state of Texas, didn't it?
Well, it said that.
Okay.
But it was not actually on behalf of the state of Texas.
Who else could it have been on behalf of?
Well, I don't think they had authority to represent the state as to the civil claims, and that's based on the holding in Lone Star Multi Theaters Inc. versus State, and they talked about this, and they said the constitutional rules are codified in Articles 2.01 and 2.02 of the Criminal Code of Procedure, which gave only county and district attorneys authority to represent the state in criminal prosecutions in district and inferior courts. In contrast, the attorney general has no authority to initiate criminal prosecutions, but is generally limited to representing the state in civil litigation. So although the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office was authorized, it, because the state doesn't have another means to enforce the laws of the state, of whether it's the county or anything, so the Tarrant County Criminal District Attorney had to bring those criminal claims. But as to the civil counterclaims, those are supposed to be represented by the Attorney General. And the state of Texas was never properly served with citations, so those, they never received notice of those claims. But the straighter, more clear answer is, even if you find that they were served and that they were present, there was no subject matter jurisdiction over any of the claims. The takings claim was not ripe. And there's two Texas Supreme Court cases specifically addressing this issue, that before a takings suit can be viable, the Chapter 47 procedure has to play out, has to run its course. And in this case, Mr. Gonzalez did file the appeal, as you noted, and he was pursuing that procedure. He also wanted to originally, he just tagged in negligence claims. That was his first counterclaims. And then he changed it, took those out, because that wouldn't work, and then he brought in the takings claim. But the Supreme Court has specifically held that operation of the Chapter 47 procedure might have been mooted by, I'll say, Mr. Gonzalez's takings claim, and this is significant, because if a remedial procedure might have obviated the need for a takings suit, then the property simply had not, prior to the procedure's use, been taken without just compensation. So there was never a viable takings claim. So the court,
is there a difference between the actual, the simple takings concept as opposed to destroying the property because of the way it was cared for?
Well, that would be negligence. And they did have originally just a negligence claim, and they withdrew that, and they just asserted the takings claim. Takings claim requires proving, and this, so in addition to that claim not being ripe and then being moot because they settled with the city for that Article 47 procedure, then they also didn't present evidence. There's three elements of the takings claim, and that's intent and damage and public use. And they don't have evidence of any of that.
Okay, but if we're dealing with a default judgment, wouldn't those elements be presumed against you on liability?
No.
Why not?
They have to prove those to establish their claim and to establish that there was a taking.
But on a default judgment, if in fact you were present and you were properly served, and you did have notice, and you didn't show up, and you have a post-answer default, do they have to introduce evidence to prove it, or is this your non appearance enough?
The non appearance is not enough. They do have to prove it still. So there has to be a basis in the record to affirm the default judgment, and there's not.
So, if I understand your position, somebody like Mr. Gonzalez, let's say that before the possession issue is decided under Article 47.01, let's say that things are stored in a warehouse and it burns down and the city or the state didn't have any insurance on that facility, are you saying that someone like Mr. Gonzalez, his remedy would be a negligence claim and that the Texas Tort Claims Act wouldn't have waived liability, wouldn't have waived immunity so that he could go after the state? I mean, what would his remedy be in that situation?
It would be a negligence claim, and it would be against the city. At all times, the parties engaged were not the state. It was the Fort Worth Police Department, it was the city of Fort Worth who stored the materials, and it was the Tarrant County Criminal District Attorney who brought the case. At no time was the state actually involved.
Could the city have filed this Chapter 47 proceeding? Or did it have to be the state via the DA's office?
It's my understanding, because I don't practice criminal law, but I understand that it had to be in the name of the state of Texas. So in addition to the takings claim not being ripe because it wasn't viable given the fact that the Article 47 procedure had not gone through. I would also point out that under the doctrine of election of remedies, the claim of, against the state must fail because his remedy was against the city. He settled against the city, and the city is a legal subdivision of the state, not an agency. And a party having more than one remedy growing out of the same right of action, here it was Gonzalez takings claim arising out of a single set of facts, is bound by the remedy he elects to pursue. And that's from a case from this court back in 1939, Mosley versus Fikes, and it was affirmed by the Texas Supreme Court. Additionally, there's no basis for a declaratory judgment claim. Not only on the face of the petition, it's not even clear that there's a declaratory judgment claim sought. You can't have a declaratory judgment claim when it's simply restating the taking claim that's already before the court. And this is significant because that's the purported basis for the award of attorney's fees, because it's well established and undisputed that a takings claim under the Constitution does not provide for an award of attorney's fees. But here, the declaratory judgment that I guess that was in the petition that I didn't see was also restating the takings claim, because the response of the brief said, seeking a declaration that his Texas constitutional were violated to support an award of attorney's fees. That was in the brief. There was nowhere in the petition. But if the sole purpose of such a declaration is to obtain a money judgment, immunity is not waived under the Declaratory Judgment Act. That's the other part of the declaratory judgment defect, is that here the only relief sought in the petition was $150,000 in damages. That's it. That's all he wanted, was damages for the property that was taken and stored and damaged, or until it was returned, and then he did get compensation from the city. But a declaratory judgment is supposed to seek the construction of a statute or city ordinance. That's not what happened here. All he wanted was a declaration that his property had been subjected to a governmental taking. And in Batista versus City of Alpine, the court said that is not a valid declaratory judgment act, and the trial court lacked jurisdiction over that claim as well. Finally, on the claims, Mr. Gonzalez, in his response to the appellant's brief, said, well, there's other theories that support default judgment. And the other theories in the petition that I found were due process, protection against unreasonable search and seizure, due course of law, and equal protection of the Texas Constitution. I assume those are his other theories, since it wasn't spelled out very clearly, but there's no facts alleged in the petition and no evidence presented to support any of those. The only facts alleged were that the city and the state took the property without probable cause or proper warrant. But if the court looks at the record, there's a valid affidavit and a valid search warrant issued by the Justice Court, and that was executed by the police department. And there was nothing invalid, and there's been no evidence presented to show that it was invalid for any reason. Texas jurisprudence does not recognize a private cause of action against a governmental agency for money damages because of alleged violations of the Constitution. So again, all the damages he sought was $150,000. Excuse me. Just like the declaratory judgment, his other theories of constitutional violations fail because his only remedy that he has sought is money damages, and that's not allowed under Beaumont versus Bullion. That's a Texas Supreme Court opinion. So the trial court lacked subject matter jurisdiction over all three of his claims, and for those reasons alone, the default judgment should be reversed and the award of attorney's fees should be reversed. But additionally, the state would say that he did not prove the elements of a takings. He did not show that anyone acted with intent. So it says intent under City of Dallas versus Jennings, Texas Supreme Court case, a government entity must have knowledge that its actions will cause harm or is likely to damage property for a taking to exist. Whether you call it a taking or an inverse condemnation, you have to show that intent. But the Fort Worth Police Department, not the state, seized the property. The Fort Worth Police Department then deposited with the City of Fort Worth possession of the property. At all times, it remained in the possession of the City of Fort Worth. The state never seized it, never had possession. There is no evidence that the state acted with intent or knowledge that any of the property would be damaged. Yes, they took it because it was suspected to be stolen, and then they proceeded with the Article 47 procedure to determine right of possession, but they never intended damage. Public use. The property is taken for public use means a definite right or use in the business or undertaking to which the property is devoted results in some use to the public. There's no evidence that any evidence that there's any use to the public. It was seized simply for investigation of possible criminal activity. That's not use for the public. That's not a business or undertaking. They didn't take the materials and then go out and build a new courthouse. That would be a public use, but that's not what happened. For these reasons, the state of Texas would ask the court to reverse and set aside the default judgment and the award of attorney's fees.
And remand it for a new trial or what?
I dismiss the claims for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. We're asking this court to affirm the judgment of the trial court and give voice to the Texas Constitution's takings clause that protects our citizens from government taking. In this case, Mr. Gonzalez's property was taken. He was never charged criminally. He was never arrested. No charges were ever brought. But yet, even though charges hadn't been filed, the state of Texas, pursuant to Chapter 47, filed a forfeiture proceeding to assert control over that. That wasn't the City of Fort Worth. That was the state of Texas under Chapter 47.
Do you disagree with the state, then, that the city would not have been the proper party to bring a Chapter 47 proceeding?
Well, I think that Chapter 47 makes it real clear that the state of Texas has to bring it, and it's brought in the name of the state of Texas. So
it's brought in the name of the state of Texas, even though the state of Texas, per se, doesn't really have anything to do with what happened?
Well, that's what the legislature, that's the statute that the legislature passed, and that is where we are focused on what the legislative intent is the language. It doesn't say brought in the name of the City of Fort Worth. It says brought by the state of Texas. And in fact, it's not brought by, prosecutor's offices in the state are actually a direct subdivision. They are part of the state of Texas. They're not even a subdivision. They just happen to have offices in the various counties and districts throughout Texas. But those, they are the state of Texas, and they have the authority to prosecute people and to represent the state of Texas in limited situations. We're going to talk about that
in just a second.
Yes. But the City of Fort Worth is not authorized by that statute to bring the statute. It's not some of the fine attorneys over at the City of Fort Worth who bring these cases. It is the state of Texas through the district attorney.
Well, could your client have filed a separate lawsuit against the City of Fort Worth for damages?
Well, I think just like you can file When there's a wrong, you can file against many different wrongdoers. There's nothing precluding them from filing a case against the state of Texas and the city of Fort Worth. There's nothing in the statute that limits them from pursuing one or the other. It's like when you sue in a medical malpractice case, you sue a doctor in a hospital. Well, you can settle the case with the hospital and still pursue the case against the doctor, or vice versa.
So I guess you would say that because of the settlement that Mr. Gonzalez received from the city, that would have been like, let's say you go to trial and get a money judgment against the state, that would just be an offset?
It is an offset, and in fact, that is what the trial court did. It did offset the amount of that settlement. But what's more, that settlement satisfied the requirements of Chapter 47. They've claimed that Chapter 47 is a prerequisite, and if that is the case, although it seems odd that the legislature can set up hoops to jump through in order to enforce your constitutional rights. But if that's the case, if Chapter 47 is a prerequisite, it was meant because, first of all, Chapter 47 is only aimed at getting property returned. Well, the property was returned by the city of Fort Worth to Mr. Gonzalez. It was returned. What could be returned, it was only about 25% of the property that was left. And what was left was a claim for compensation for the property that he didn't get back. And so Chapter 47 satisfied, prerequisite satisfied. Now he's got a claim for damages for the amount left over. But to go back, the state of Texas is the entity represented by the district attorney's office that is authorized in Chapter 47 to represent the state and will disagree with the state of Texas's characterization. Chapter 47 is not a criminal statute. It is a civil statute. It is a civil claim brought in civil courts because it has to do with property, not liberty. We're not putting someone in prison, and that's why the claims are brought in JP and then county court at law.
Interestingly, 47.01 says the magistrate sitting in the original proceeding sits by criminal jurisdiction, but when it goes to the county court, it's governed by the civil rules, right?
That's correct.
So if it's governed by the civil rules when it goes to county court, why, you know, it seems to me like Rule 124 says that you can serve a counterclaim upon whoever is representing them by serving their attorney, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
But tell us about the special authority that you're talking about that the DAs have to represent the state of Texas in civil proceedings.
Well, they have the authority to represent the state of Texas in Chapter 47 claims when they convert to civil claims in county court of law. They are the ones charged with pursuing those claims for forfeiture in civil court.
But Chapter 47 doesn't touch the idea of money damages for destroyed property.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And that's why it cannot foreclose a takings claim for damages when the property is destroyed.
Well, what about, okay, so I understand that Mr. Gonzalez's property was taken by the Fort Worth Police Department, but talk to us about the state's argument that it wasn't a taking in the sense that there was no intent, and it wasn't taken for a public use.
Steele versus City of Houston, Your Honor, it's a 1980 Texas Supreme Court case. And in that case, some individuals had there were three escaped convicts, and the police, in their wisdom in chasing the convicts, destroyed their building. And the Texas Supreme Court held there that that was a public use. The fact that they were involved in pursuing criminal charges or criminal subjects, that it was a taking for public use. I think that the Texas Supreme Court has answered that question in Steele versus City of Houston. They're not doing it for a private use. It's brought by the government under Chapter 47. That per se is for a public use. They are claiming that our client should forfeit the property, and the property should go to the state of Texas.
But shouldn't that question, I mean, this goes back to, I guess, the VSC case, mm-hmm. The idea that a takings claim isn't ripe until the issue of the Chapter 47, you know, who gets the property has been decided first.
Well, that was decided in this case. It was decided that Mr. Gonzalez would get the property. He got the property back. And the court ordered that. But unfortunately, some of the property had been destroyed. And so what's left is a claim for compensation under the takings clause of the Texas Constitution.
I just had one question. You, in citing Steele against versus City of Houston, why shouldn't this case have been against the City of Fort Worth, the takings claim?
Well, it can be. There can be two entities involved in a taking, and there were in this case. The City of Fort Worth was involved in holding the property. The state of Texas filed a forfeiture proceeding claiming that that property should not be released to Mr. Gonzalez. It was under a statute created by the state of Texas. If we did not have the unconstitutional forfeiture statute that allows the government, without charging someone with a crime and without convicting someone of a crime, to take their property away, it would be like filing the government being able to take Mr. Hernandez's house and hold his house until he proves that, I don't know, that he owns it. But he has to go through a proceeding to do it.
But it still requires a probable cause affidavit, right?
Well, it does.
It's not like the city can just go out and take things willy-nilly.
It does, but interestingly in this case, the entire police evidence file was destroyed and missing. That's a Brady violation. It can be presumed that the contents of that file that the district attorney filed in this case, that all of that evidence would have exonerated Mr. Gonzalez, and that was a part of the trial court record, which would allow affirmance of the judgment. So the City of Fort Worth, in answer to your question, can be a party. Chapter 47 wasn't in play in Steele versus City of Houston. It is Chapter 47, and it is the state of Texas taking the step of filing for a forfeiture that is a part and parcel of the taking of Mr. Gonzalez's property. With regard to Rule 124, first of all, the state of Texas says, well, we weren't served. Well, the statute they cite is for claims under the Tort Claims Act. We didn't bring a tort. We amended out any tort claims. We only brought constitutional claims. The state of Texas had filed, was before the court. They had exercised jurisdiction. They had indicated that they wanted to bring it forward. So because they're a party, 124 says they can be served with a counterclaim. Now, it's like a situation with a car wreck. In a car wreck, there can be two people that run a red light. And one person sues the other person, and then the other person, maybe they go and hire Dwayne Dent. And then and they sue the person, and Mike Brantley files an answer on behalf of that person, and they file a counterclaim. They hire a separate lawyer and file a counterclaim. And Dwayne Dent says, well, I can't represent you because you had insurance. So they call the insurance company and they bring them in. That's what they should have done here. And in fact, that's what they did here. There's an email from Mr. Lund from the district attorney's office the day that they withdrew from the case pursuant to the direction of the judge, that they emailed this counsel right here, who appeared right after judgment was entered, that we're withdrawing and you can enter the case. Then the state of Texas gets, they don't enter an appearance. And then the state of Texas gets notice of a trial setting and they don't enter an appearance. And they wait curiously until 4 days after judgment is entered, even though they've been notified. This is not a case where the state of Texas didn't know what was going on. This isn't a case where the state of Texas wasn't a party to the proceeding. This is a case where there was some games being played. And Mr. Gonzalez moved forward against a party that was before the court that he'd served a counterclaim on.
On a post-answer default, is it required to have evidence in the record supporting your elements of liability as well as damages?
I believe that. Yes, I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
What's your evidence of your elements on your takings claim?
Well, one, it's all in the court record, the seizure of the property. Two, my client testifies. Three, in the court record, the state of Texas filed that the evidence in their position had been destroyed. I believe the court can infer from all of that evidence that it was taken. It was taken for public use. And then he testified with regard to his own property, which he can do, the value of that property. We didn't try to run it up. We took a credit for the property that was returned. He took a credit for the amount of money received by the city of Fort Worth, and the remainder is what he sought.
Well, what was the evidence of the intent element of a takings claim?
Well, they filed the forfeiture proceeding without arresting it, without
well,
any...
So you don't think that there needed to be an intent on the state's part to destroy or deal negligently with the property or to not take proper care of it?
Yeah, no. I think that it has to do... It's just like the Steele versus City of Houston case where they destroy the building next door. They weren't trying to destroy the building. They were trying to catch the bad guys. But they destroyed the building, and the Texas Supreme Court said, well, these folks get compensation for their building. That's why I think Steele controls. With regard to, now, I'm going to concede something. We probably, because we don't expressly have a claim for declaratory relief for a declaration, we probably don't have a claim for, under the Declaratory Judgment Act that allows us to recover the attorney's fees. So after hearing their arguments and studying their arguments, given what the case law is, that is probably, there is not a declaration. If the case is remanded, which the court shouldn't do, the court should affirm the judgment of the court. But I must concede that given the state of the law, that we probably aren't entitled to attorney's fees because we don't have, there's not a express declaration for a violation of the Constitution. You probably need an express declaration that a statute violated the Constitution in order to recover under the Declaratory Judgment Act. And unfortunately, we don't have that.
We appreciate the candor.
They actually raised some of these issues about the insufficiency of the evidence in their reply brief. And so they're required under the rules, Texas rules of appellate procedure, to raise all issues in their appellate brief. And we would object to any relief being granted on any new issues raised in the reply brief as violative of the Texas rules of appellate procedure. Finally, they entered the case 5 days after, 4 or 5 days after judgment was entered, and they had the opportunity to request findings of fact and conclusions of law, and they didn't do it, and therefore the court can consider any theory that is pled as being supported, and since they didn't challenge any of those other theories, the court could affirm on that.
So that what evidence was there of your other theories? What were the elements of those that you proved up?
Yeah, the Equal Protection Clause, my client is Hispanic. His property was taken without being arrested, without being charged for a crime, without being convicted of a crime. So under the Equal Protection Clause, he is not being provided equal protection of the laws. He could further argue that he's not being provided equal protection of the laws because of his race. I think that reasonably could be inferred from the evidence, and those are the elements. With regard to the, and interestingly, Section 3A of Article 1 of the Texas Constitution says that it is self-executing. And no court has ever addressed this, but it is self-executing, which means there doesn't have to be a statute that allows for a There are scholars that would argue that that means it creates a private right of action if there's a violation of that provision, that you don't even need a waiver of sovereign immunity because it's set forth.
Scholars would say, are there any cases that say that?
There's not. There's not a court that has dealt with that issue, I don't believe. James Harrington has a book about the history of the Texas Constitution. It's a pretty scholarly article that goes through the adoption of the Equal Protection Clause and the Equal Rights Amendment, and it's saying that it is self-executing. So we have a right to due process, which was violated, and our client wasn't afforded the opportunity, notice of why his property was being taken. And so he
did. Your client not get served with an affidavit, a warrant?
He did, but again, all of the police officer's file is missing. It's gone, and he doesn't have the right. He doesn't have the ability to cross-examine the veracity of what the state was alleging against him because it's destroyed conveniently.
Does the Brady presumption apply in a civil case?
It does, Your Honor. And they are the ones who made the Brady disclosure in this proceeding. So they are the ones who admitted that evidence had been destroyed. It's an interesting question whether or not they were required under Brady to disclose it in a civil case.
And what is your authority that presumption applies in the civil case?
Well, the authority is just like any adverse evidence. If there's evidence that a piece of vital evidence was destroyed, then there can be adverse inferences and presumptions.
Texas Supreme Court has some pretty different opinions with respect to destruction of evidence and the presumptions that may or may not arise. And I'm just wondering if you are familiar with anything involving those rules in a Brady situation.
Yeah, I'm not, Your Honor. I don't think that it's a case. I think it's a case of first impression. But those Texas Supreme Court cases have to do with, will there be an instruction to the jury about those presumptions in a jury charge? Not can a finder of fact infer from the absence of that evidence or the fact that that evidence was destroyed after the case was brought, that a finder of fact can infer,
make negative inferences from that.
Especially in a bench trial, do you have any case law on that application in the context of a bench trial?
I don't have specifically a situation involving the Brady-type disclosure where evidence is destroyed, but this court in Bell Helicopter versus Burnett, you know, said that a trial court is allowed to take all inferences from all of the record, including not only the witnesses, but those things on file are not on file.
And
in this case, there's an affirmative disclosure that they don't have.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Your time's up.
Okay. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Smith wants it both ways. He wants to say this is not a criminal case, and then he cites Steele, which he says was a criminal case, and that was why they found that there was a taking. So he's arguing out of both sides of his mouth, and a lot of what he says doesn't make sense. I really have a problem with that one, but he claims that the trial court's award of damages was an offset. But if you look at the testimony on damages, it's insufficient. The evidence is just insufficient. And he says again, also, Mr. Smith says, we raised it for the first time in our reply. That's not even true. Section 3 of appellant's brief on page 34 starts the section discussing the legally and factually insufficient evidence supporting the default judgment. Maybe we spent a little more time on it, went into a little more detail, but it's not a surprise. And it's not a surprise because Mr. Gonzalez testified to a value, and he claimed to have receipts for this value, but he never presented them. The only exhibits put in at the trial were Exhibits 1 and 2, and the only thing in those exhibits is an inventory list. One exhibit, it was hard to tell from the record, but I think one exhibit came from the affidavit supporting the search warrant and the seizure, and it had a list of items. Another list, Mr. Gonzalez said it was his inventory. But neither one of them identified the value of any of those items. Neither one of them identified items that were reclaimed by Mr. Gonzalez. Neither one of them identified items that were damaged by Mr. Gonzalez, while they were in custody of the police. So there is no evidence of the value that he claims to be $150,000, or what he settled with the city minus that to $112,000 was the default judgment. As the Texas Supreme Court stated in Burrow versus Arce, ipsy dixit is not sufficient to state the claimed market value. Quote, a claim will not stand or fall on the mere ipsy dixit of a credentialed witness. I deal with this all the time in actual condemnation taking cases. And the ipsy dixit is a person getting up saying, I'm the property owner and I think it's worth $150,000. Okay, where's your support for that? You have to have support. You can't just say, I said it, so it's true. And he did not have anything to support his value. So the damages is not supported at all in the default judgment. Questions about whether or not the Tarrant County Criminal District Attorney filing an answer or an appearance on behalf of the state. Well, let's say it was a divorce case, and Joe is retained by the wife, and he files an answer. And Joe's partner says, well, I'm going to file an answer on behalf of the husband. But the husband has no clue. You can't enter a default judgment against him. He's like, and the attorney says, or Joe says, well, I told my partner about it, and he's going to represent the guy. That should be enough. Well, it's not.
Well, if the state of Texas is still the state of Texas, regardless of who's representing it, correct?
The state of Texas is, but in different capacities. And again, he wants to say it was a criminal case, a civil case. Well, which is it? Well, it was a criminal case. Article 47 procedure is under the Code of Criminal Procedure. This was not a civil case that was brought.
Except once it goes to the court of to the county court, it's then governed by the rules of civil procedure, correct?
The procedure is, but the evidence required to establish the claims is not.
The procedure for serving counterclaims is under the rules of civil procedure, correct?
That may be correct, but the state wasn't there.
The state was there because their lawyer was there, and their lawyer received the counterclaim in a means authorized by the rules of civil procedure, didn't it?
Well, I disagree because they were civil claims. And it started out as criminal claims. And he makes a big deal about the file being lost. Well, I don't know about the file being lost, but that doesn't have anything to do with the takings claim that he asserted.
Let's focus on the issue of the lawyer.
Yes.
And the party. The state of Texas is the party.
Yes.
Okay? And the state of Texas only has one capacity. It's the state. It's the sovereign state, right?
Yes, but there was no state actor.
But the state is the party. It's brought in the name of the state of Texas, right?
It's in the name of the state, yes.
Okay. Represented by the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office, right? I see the time's up. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, no, it's an intriguing question. You can answer very briefly if you can.
Okay. So it was named the name of the state. The state is not actually the party. The county, the criminal district attorney representing the Fort Worth Police Department actions and the city of Fort Worth actions on the criminal procedure side. They were representing, it says in the name of the state, but that's just the way that they're required to phrase the style of the case.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Counsel, the oral argument has been very helpful. We appreciate your time, and your case is submitted. We'll stand in recess until 2:30.